This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. This week, Jonathan Bennett and I talk with Jonathan Steck and Sean Merrill, both of Endless Sky. Endless Sky is, we think, one of the premier open source games. It's a really exciting game. It's in space. It's a lot of fun. It actually runs on more than just the Linux platform. It's also on Android. A lot of fun. And these guys, we talked to them 2 years ago. We're catching up with this one. A lot has happened in the meantime. It's like a much more expanded team. They're doing really good work. If you want to get into how games are made in the open source world, this is the show to see or listen to, and that is coming up next. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Cisco Meraki. Without a cloud-managed network, businesses inevitably fall behind. Experience the ease and efficiency of Meraki's single platform to elevate the place where your employees and customers come together. Cisco Meraki maximizes uptime and minimizes loss to digitally transform your organization. Meraki's intuitive interface, increased connectivity, and multi-site management keep your organization operating seamlessly and securely wherever your team is. Let Cisco Meraki's 24/7 available support help your organization's remote, on-site, and hybrid teams always do their best work. Visit meraki.cisco.com/twit.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 742, recorded Wednesday, July 26th, 2023. Endless Sky, Endless Fun. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Cisco Meraki. With employees working in different locations, providing a unified work experience seems as easy as herding cats. How do you rein in so many moving parts? With Meraki Cloud Managed Network. Learn how your organization can make hybrid work work. Visit meraki.cisco.com/twit. And by Fastmail, reclaim your privacy, boost productivity, and make email yours with Fastmail. Try it now free for 30 days at fastmail.com/twit. And by Bitwarden. Get the open source password manager that can help you stay safe online. Get started with a free Teams or Enterprise plan trial, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. Hello again, everyone, everywhere. This is Floss Weekly. I am Doc Searles, and this week, joined by Jonathan Bennett, Jay Bennett himself.
Hey, how are you, Doc? Screen. Good to be here.
Good to be here, too. Yeah. Wherever here is now an average of Oklahoma and Boston, which is, I'm in a basement apartment here in Boston, which I think I'm in like once or twice a decade. But and the AC turned down all the way. And yesterday we arrived here and it was hot, and we immediately thought the thing near the door was the air conditioner, and it was broken. It was the dehumidifier and the air conditioner, which you might be able to see in the wall behind me there. That's the actual air conditioner. Yeah, and it is working. Unit. It's on quiet right now. Yeah.
Yes. Those are nice. That's actually why my office is not 80 degrees anymore. I put one of those in out here. And
A split unit, like, meaning that the part you see is here, but the part that's throwing heat outside is somewhere else completely.
Yes.
Yeah. Not like in a window, which is cool. Yeah. I like those. You see these all over Europe. They're pretty cool.
Yeah. They're real popular in Europe.
Yeah. Yeah. So today's show features Endless Sky. This is your idea and you're a player.
It is. I am a player. We were talking before the show got started. I got somewhat addicted to Endless Sky. It's a video game about space exploration. I got somewhat addicted to it back a few months ago and played through pretty much all of the released content for it. And of course, that content ends on a cliffhanger, and I've not been back since then. But there's quite a bit of new content that we're going to for sure ask these guys about. But it's a lot of fun. It's it's kind of your typical, exploration and trading and fighting. But rather than being in 3D, it's actually in two dimensions. So it's a top down view on all of this as you're moving your spaceships around and all of that. But it's really interesting. It's a lot of fun. I don't know that I'm doing it quite justice in my description of it, but I really enjoy it.
Yeah. And it is open source, right? So yes. Anybody wishing to contribute and improve on it is there. Well, I want to jump into this. So we're going to bring in not one, but two guests this morning, this evening, whenever it is. Sean and Jonathan, not to be confused with the other Jonathan. Half of the people on this show are Jonathans right now.
In hindsight, we may have made a grave error here.
Sorry, we only allowed one on the show. Yeah. So, and one is lead artist and one is lead developer, and both of them kind of half disclaim that because it's a team thing. So why don't we just start with Jonathan Steck? Is that right? Do I have that
Steck,
right?
Steck, yeah.
Steck. So tell us about yourself and what you're doing there with Endless Sky.
All right. Well, so I'm Jonathan Steck. I'm effectively the lead developer. I was kind of saying before the show, that was kind of a de facto title for a couple of years now, but I think relatively recently we've kind of concretely said like, oh yeah, this guy's the lead developer. I lead the developer team. So we have a team of, I believe it's 10 developers at the moment. Don't want to start naming names in fear of missing someone, but so the point of the developers are the ones who have write access to the game's repository on GitHub. And we've been chosen over the years from among the community. We have people who were interested in making content for the game or making new features, updating the engine, fixing bugs, helping out with CI/CD jobs on GitHub. Just people who were pretty much experts in their field to an extent, who we noticed like were really good at helping out with the game and were really interested in doing so. And so we reached out to them and were like, hey, do you want to become a developer? Do you want write access? Do you want to kind of lead things here? So that kind of begs the question of, though, who was the first one? So the first one was actually this guy called Michael Zonizer. So as Jonathan Bennett described, Endless Sky is this top-down 2D space adventure game. It has text-based choose-your-own-adventure type aspects to it. And it was started by Michael Zonizer back in 2014 and 2015 as a spiritual successor to the Escape Velocity series from Ambrosia Software from back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And he built this game mostly on his own, but he seemed to have some friends and family who looked to help out because they're in the credits under beta testers. And he developed the game almost primarily by himself from 2015 up until about 2018. But closer to 2018, we noticed that he was starting to slow down his involvement in the game. There's a lot less pull requests being merged, a lot less commits being made by him. And we, at this time, had a bunch of people who were really excited in this game and contributing to the game. So eventually he noticed, hey, I don't have enough time, but you guys seem to have a lot of time on your hands. You're really passionate about this game. So he made myself, Pointed Stick, and DeHouch contributors to the game or collaborators to the repository where we could have the right access to actually build up the game ourselves. And since then, it was us who were working on it. And over the years, as I said, we've built up our developer team to now 10 individuals. So that's basically the long and short of it.
So Sean, what did Jonathan just miss? And tell us a bit about yourself.
So I'm Sean Reynolds. I'm a bit newer to the team within the last year or two. I mainly work with the art of the game and making sure it's all fitting together nicely. I'm also one of those 10 developers, but art is definitely more my expertise in things. Code is something I'm a little bit away from, but in terms of content and artwork, that's more my vibe. I played the original Escape Velocity series that this game is based on, and building up from there, it's kind of done a lot of justice in my life in terms of my career. So a lot of like what I do nowadays with just art and modeling, all that stuff is from those original days, and it's just really cool to be part of a similar project and be trying to help out with the community and get some stuff going for it.
I'm very much reminded of an XKCD comic where it's you know, the things that contributed to my career success. And it's like, you know, 10th grade, 11th grade, 12th grade, these little tiny graphs. And then in that one, it's messing around with Python that one weekend is like this huge part of the graph. It fascinates me the way that careers work, and not necessarily the way that they're supposed to. We'll get into that more. I actually want to ask Jonathan about a little bit more about that transition of power, as it was, where you had the original lead developer that kind of faded away from the scenes. Was there a bit of a challenge getting like full admin access to the GitHub repository? And then I know there was quite a story about the Steam page, the Steam store. Let's dive into that a little bit more.
So last time we were on, we talked about how Michael Zonizer had given me and the others, as I mentioned, right access to the repository, but right access isn't total access. We don't have admin access. We also had no access to Steam. So I'll mention that the game is distributed on GitHub, of course, but also on Steam and on Debian and some other locations that you might find it. But the officially supported ones are GitHub and Steam. Steam is where a lot of our player base came from. It's where I came from. It's where I imagine Sean came from. Correct me if I'm wrong, though. So the fact that we didn't have access to update the game on Steam was a big blow, which meant because we had all this content like finished and ready to go, we just couldn't give it to a vast majority of the players. In this time, we found some workarounds. So we actually developed a continuous branch. Or not a continuous branch, but like a continuous job on the GitHub, so that every time there's a new commit, it will make a new build and it'll put that on the release page for everyone to access. We started to have people notice, oh, hey, the game's dead. Is there anything going on? They would come to the GitHub page. They would start finding the continuous build so they can actually still continue to play the game. But that still left out a lot of people who didn't even know the game was on GitHub. Since then, we actually do now have access to the game on Steam, and we have admin access on the repository as of about a year and a half ago now. So March of last year, one of our community members, ZitJazz, actually reached out to Michael and was like, hey, thanks for giving us the right access so we can continue to develop the game. But things are starting to kind of slow down now because we're not getting the releases from you onto Steam. And there are things that we would like to do that we just can't do right now because we don't have the proper access. And Michael responded. He was like, hey, I understand. So what he did was he actually converted his own GitHub account into an organization, which meant we actually lost all of the history of his commits, which is kind of, I think like the commits are still there, but they don't link to an account anymore, which is kind of weird. Right. And his name is no longer in the contributors, if you go to the insight on the GitHub stats. But yeah. But in doing that, though, he made ZitJazz himself on a new account and DeHouch admins on the repository. And he gave MCO, one of our other developers, developer access on Steam. So because of that, as of like that year and a half ago, we're now actually able to do basically anything we want to do. There are still some bumps here and there that we're trying to work out. Like we're not too sure on what should an admin on the repository be doing? What should a developer be doing that the admin isn't, and vice versa. So we do have some organizational things to still work out that we're actively working on. But for the most part, things have been a lot smoother sailing than they were years ago.
Right. Now, I'm curious, as a community, have you kind of anointed someone as the benevolent dictator of the entire project? Or is there just kind of a group of loose people that make the decisions? What does that part look like?
I don't want to call myself the benevolent dictator. Some people are going to take that out of context. We do have a bit of like a balance of power situation. So I mentioned that DeHouch, Michael, and ZitJazz are admins. DeHouch has been inactive recently. He actually got married, bought a house. We joke around that he has kids now because he's been away that long. But and Michael still hasn't returned to the game. But ZitJazz is the admin who is currently the active admin. And he is separate from the developer team at the moment. And because of that, we do have this balance of powers where the developer team has some say on things. He has some say on things. There's a bit of a back and forth there. And then we also have two people who we call our community organizers. Those are Hector and Master of Gray. And they are a lot more involved in the community aspect of things. So whenever they feel like there is a deficit in the way the developer team is doing something with the community, they will point that out and be like, hey, I think you should be a bit more communicative with the community, or you should maybe add a new role here and there. Because we have so we have a Discord server with almost 5,000 people on it now. Oh, wow. And that is where a majority of the game's development actually happens, or at least the discussions about the development happens there. Because we'll spitball ideas back and forth, and just all sorts of stuff on there. We'll talk crap about each other. But we also have this. So speaking of the organizers, though, something that was Gray's idea primarily, I believe, was the creation of this suite of what we call reviewer with a capital R. And our reviewers are people who we recognize as actually being pretty good at giving positive feedback reviews, or like good feedback reviews to new pull requests that come in. So we'll have like grammar reviewers, spelling reviewers, or code reviewers and content reviewers. And these people, we give this title of reviewer. We give them triage permissions on the repository so that they can help us add labels where we need to, and maybe slightly moderate conversation here and there. And those are the ones that we the developers primarily look to for help. So they're kind of like the front lines of things, so to speak. And they're primarily the number one pick for new developers should we ever decide to add someone else with write access to the repository.
All right. Now, let me kind of ask Sean some of the same questions. Where do you fit into this? Are you... we just heard about this idea of reviewers. Are you the head reviewer for new content? What all is under your purview?
So, actually, to come off of what he was saying, I worked my way up through as a reviewer to become a developer. Uh-huh. When I joined, I was immediately passionate about everything. I wanted to get artwork into the game. I wanted to take a look at other people's how they do it. So I ended up being an artwork reviewer for a while, and like he was saying, there's a lot of people throughout the years who made artwork for the game. I am by no means the only person, and there's people who have done quite a lot more work than I have. But a few notable people, so Becca Bunny is a name that comes to mind. There's another name called Gefu. I can't pronounce the rest of it. So there's a lot of people who have contributed quite a lot of artwork to the game, and eventually John was saying how it'd be beneficial to have like an artwork dev to kind of keep track of what new artwork gets added to the game, because we were in the middle of like this period where we updated a lot of the models, and from like, you know, years of them just sitting there, they've been detailed quite a bit, and you can tell the difference. Like back in the day, they were just very basic top view images, and some of them were even just drawn, and Michael did some in Inkscape, just top down views. And nowadays we have people making them in Blender, and like different versions of Blender. So some people are sitting in the older versions, and some people are like on the newest one. Some people are using GIMP for post processing. Other people are using Blender internal engines for post processing, and there's just so many different the ways that the art's made for the game, and it's all like, you know, it's all free stuff, which is what Michael wanted. So that's where I come in. So I look at all the artwork of the game. I look at some content of the game, like story-wise, but not really anywhere near as much as Jonathan does. But yeah, that's where I'm at.
So how does that work as far, because there's in Endless Sky, there's different factions, there's different races. Who has ownership? Like, is there one person that just has ownership of the entire storyline, or is it broken down into parts and different people kind of take ownership of their little bit of the pie?
You mean like the overall storyline or each faction storyline?
Well, either way, which way does it work?
So faction stories, usually they come from the mind of the person who wrote, like, you know, the faction owner, so to speak. Once someone submits their faction to be added to the game, though, it does become like quote unquote property of Endless Sky, as in it works with everybody else. So they do have a say in the faction, but when something is merged into vanilla, they kind of have to work with everything else that's in the game, make sure there's nothing that's too far from the base vision of the game. It's like nothing crazy. Specifically with artwork, there's like a kind of a set of guidelines, so to speak, for it. We have templates for the lighting of the ships. So it's like, it's basically just the lighting and trying to do the similar texturing with top-down view. So
kind of a style guide that you give everybody.
Yeah, like a style guide. And right. Most people, like over the years, it's always been overlaying textures and stuff like that on top of the ships. But with one of the images you guys showed, some people are starting to do everything in Blender now. Mm-hmm. It is kind of a juggle to try and get these different looking factions and ships all together to match the game. But spoiler, aliens on one side of the galaxy that look quite different from the other side of the galaxy. But it all kind of comes down to keeping design, like you said, like a style guide. So like not overly detailed art graphics, not under detailed, same lighting, same shading, stuff like that.
As you get some things done in 3D, completely done in Blender, I have to imagine that, you know, if you look at it, you've now got this nice 3D model that theoretically looks great from any side, although on that last shot, the bottom of that may have been completely untextured. We don't know. Does that kind of make your spider senses tingle and think, boy, there's some possibilities here that we're not really using with just a 2D top-down view?
That kind of is like what I talked about earlier with whole our transition to thumbnails way in the past. So that was a big opportunity. So everything wasn't top view anymore. Now there's three dimensions. And same thing with like landscape images and scenes is something about in the game. So like having different angles of the ships or where they might be sitting at in like a shipyard or outfits. When you're unlocking a new outfit, like that example right there, it's showing one. It's like a little garage with like a gun in it and a bunch of parts laying everywhere. That's not something you would normally see from the original top view of the game. And there have been people who make animations with the ships and the assets in the game. So I'm not sure if our engine can handle like straight these like movie style animations quite yet. But it's definitely a definite tingles my spider sense. I'm like, oh, I want to see those in more places than just top down.
Yes. Has anybody seriously kicked around the idea of porting all of the storyline and the graphics to something like the Vega Strike engine or the Free Space engine?
I don't believe so.
I know. I do understand the incredible mountain of work that I just spitballed there.
Oh. Yeah. Well, guys, I want to get to some more questions, but first we have to let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Cisco Meraki, the experts in cloud-based networking for hybrid work. Whether your employees are working at home, at a cabin in the mountains, or in a lounge chair at the beach, a cloud-managed network provides the same exceptional work experience no matter where they are. You may as well roll out the welcome mat because hybrid work is here to stay. Hybrid work works best in the cloud and has its perks for both employees and leaders. Workers can move faster and deliver better results with a cloud-managed network, while leaders can automate distributed operations, build more sustainable workspaces, and proactively protect the network. An IDG Marketplace research report conducted for Meraki highlights top-tier opportunities in supporting hybrid work. For example, hybrid work is a priority for 78% of C-suite executives. Leaders want to drive collaboration forward while staying on top of or boosting productivity and security. Hybrid work also has its challenges. The IDG report raises the red flag about security, noting that 48% of leaders report cybersecurity threats as a primary obstacle to improving workforce experiences. Always-on security monitoring is part of what makes the cloud-managed network so awesome. IT can use apps from Meraki's vast ecosystem of partners, turnkey solutions built to work seamlessly with the Meraki cloud platform for asset tracking, location analytics, and more to gather insights on how people use their workspaces. In a smart space, environmental sensors can track activity and occupancy levels to stay on top of cleanliness. Reserve workspaces based on vacancy and employee profiles, also called hot desking, which allows employees to quickly scout out a place to work. Locations in restricted environments can be booked in advance and include time-based door access. There's mobile device management, integrating devices and systems to allow IT to manage, update, and troubleshoot company-owned devices even when the devices and employees are in a remote location. Turn any space into a place of productivity and empower your organization with the same exceptional experience no matter where they work with Meraki and the Cisco suite of technology. Learn how your organization can make hybrid work work. Visit Meraki, that's M-E-R-A-K-I, .cisco.com/twit. So I'm wondering about the 5,000 people on Discord. We know about the reviewers so far. What are the other, you know, in the boiling system that is there, what else is emerging as roles as the whole thing matures? And either one of you guys can answer that one, I guess.
So I'll say that we don't have 5,000 people working on the game, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It's a vast majority of it is just players of the game who, because we actually have the link to the Discord server in the game's credits. So if you're actually looking through the credits, you can see that. If you're interested in being on the server, well, you can come show up, talk about the game, see what people are going on with. But the main roles in the server are, we have our developers. We have our community organizers that I mentioned. We have some moderators just to make sure that no one's, you know, doing anything too crazy on the server. Then we have our reviewers, which I already mentioned. And we also have a group of people who we call our core members. And the core members are just people who we have recognized as sticking with the game for a long time and who usually are people who have contributed to the game. Not only in the sense of they have commits on the repository, but contributions can also come in the form of creating new tools for the development of the game or just making plugins. I'll note that part of the goal of Endless Sky is to have it be highly moddable. So we have this extensive plugin system that allows you to make anything you want. If you see the game doing something, then you can do that thing. And even more than that, because there's actually a lot of mechanics that the engine is capable of that we currently aren't using at the moment. Mainly because somebody will have an idea for a feature and we'll be like, hey, that sounds like a good feature. Let's add it to the game's engine. But then we just never get around to finding a good spot for it to actually show up in the story.
A member who just recently opened a pull request to have plugins installable and openable through the game itself. So, and we have all these, like, we have a different launcher to launch the plugins. We recently do have that capability to disable them or enable them. So, yeah, modding is really a really big important part of it.
So, I am curious about something. Is there any voice acting in the game?
There is not.
And is that something will never be. there will never be?
Unlikely. So I mentioned earlier that the game's story is all text. So you'll land on a planet, you'll get a mission, and the mission is it's all text. If we were to voice act, that's a lot of text to voice act. If we were only to use it sparingly, we kind of have to question, like, why would we only be using it sparingly? Where would we even use it? At a certain point, it feels like it would just be like, would stick out like a sore thumb, like, oh, why is this voice acted, not that? We do want to keep a relatively consistent quality to the game overall. Mm-hmm. And if we were to start voice acting in one area, that would kind of egg on to the rest of the game, like, hey, why isn't this voice acted? And that would just be a big mess for us to actually deal with.
Sure. Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, it's kind of one of those things with, like, when you're reading a book and people like to imagine the voices of the characters themselves. And I feel like if we give everybody voices, that might kind of narrow the vision of them a little bit more than we'd like to.
So I'm kind of remembering, I think it was a Skyrim mod that somebody came up with. And it did two things, if I remember correctly. First, it used ChatGPT to create on-the-fly dialogue, and then it used some other, you know, AI engine to voice that dialogue, and ended up with this really novel game that every time you talked to an NPC, they would come up with a slightly different bit of dialogue, and it would be voiced. And I thought that was a really cool cool idea. There's this article I saw on Hackaday just a couple of days ago about Bark, which is an open source voice acting module that when I was thinking about the show before we started, it occurred to me that it would be really fun to take something like this and get it to do your voice acting for you for some open source game. And so I wanted to pitch the idea to you guys and see what you thought.
Sean actually has
done
a topic.
Silence.
Oh yeah. No. Actually, I was expecting AI to be brought up.
I was going to do it eventually anyway, but yeah,
you've got me already. Considered the usage of it. It's mainly what's brought up for it is using it for like landscapes, because landscapes for the planets are usually images from free source sites like Unsplash or some NASA images. We did initially have like a channel on Discord for people to throw like out examples of AI and stuff like that, but we ultimately decided just for things as they are now, we kind of don't want AI to be used in the game quite yet. And that's not because it's like a super bad thing or anything. It's partly because there's a lot of copyright issues when it comes to AI and what they generate and where they source it from, if it's from the person or like their libraries. And the other part is we do have a lot of dedicated creators who would love to make this kind of content themselves and make the scenes in Blender or things like that.
So this is for Sean. I think we're reaching a point, and I might be wrong about this, where you can spot AI art. It looks like AI art, even the good stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you agree with that. Certainly with people, it's possible. I mean, some of them, like the eyeballs aren't right, you know, stuff like that. But even with landscapes and shapes and, you know, show me a bunch of spacemen. What do those look like? And it makes up a bunch of things that are sort of Star Wars derived. Mm-hmm. and they're plausible, but there's something a little bit weird and glossy about them. And I'm wondering if I'm right about that, or if that's just a projection on my part.
Yeah, I think that's it does get a little hard to tell at times, but it's especially predominant with people with, like, you know, hands and other appendages like that. With landscapes, I guess that could come into play with like shading or like texture consistency, like maybe something blurs lines together towards like the horizon or between different materials. So it's definitely, you can definitely tell, but I do think there is way things are going to where it's harder to tell nowadays, but at least in my thought, there will always be like a way to tell. You can't, like, AI, I don't think we'll be able to perfectly manipulate what a person can do, but that's not to say they can't do a good job of trying to. So I
want to throw something in here. My daughter, who's a theater professor at the University of Maryland in mm-hmm. Baltimore, just wrote a book called A Galaxy of Things, and it's about Star Wars puppets and Star Wars characters that are not human but have human qualities. And I did a whole bunch of covers for her that just said A Galaxy of Things using AI. She went with an artist. So I just wanted to report that and get a plug in for her book. So, yeah. So I'm wondering. Oh, go ahead, Jonathan. You had a question.
Okay, so yeah, I think before we let you guys go, we've got about half the show left. Let's cover what's changed. What's new in Endless Sky since the last time we talked to you? It's been probably a couple of years now. I think we've got a couple. You've got a couple of releases under your belt. What's the new goodies?
Oh, where do you even start? Is the problem? So we have two new alien factions. We have greatly expanded capabilities in the engine. So by that, I mean missions can be a lot more complex. We have a lot more complex things that the ships and the outfits are capable of doing. Mm-hmm. I think my favorite thing, I don't know if this was since we last spoke, but it probably was actually. Back several years ago, so there's this section in the save file for all of your characters called the conditions section. And the conditions is basically just the map where the keys are strings and the values are integers. Mm-hmm. And whenever you are trying to figure out when to do something in a mission, you have to check the condition map. So you could say something like, in order for this mission to offer, you have to have finished this mission and your combat rating has to be above 3,000 or something like that. So combat rating is just a measure of how much combat you've engaged in. The problem with this map was that if there was ever any information we wanted to be able to access through a to offer on a mission, we had to first put it in the map. So for example, if we wanted to check if the player has a certain outfit installed on their ship, we had to stick in the map, this outfit exists, basically, or this outfit has a count of one. Now, if you wanted to do that for every outfit in your fleet, but also ask where that outfit is, you're massively ballooning the number of entries in this map, mm-hmm. which was just impossible to work with after a certain point. One of our developers, Peter V. DeMere, actually completely refactored how the conditions are constructed. So we do still have a map of conditions that are set under certain conditions that are just static values where, again, you have a string and you have a value that is in your save file. If you want to go in and tweak it, you can. And those are always accessible. But he also added what we've called auto conditions or derived conditions, where we have certain keywords for this map that instead of storing them inside the map itself, if you call this keyword, there is a function that we define that actually goes and grabs the information on the fly. So the example of your outfits, you can now see which outfits you have, but also tell what condition or what state that outfit is in. Is it on your flagship? Is it on your escorts? Is it in another system? Is it in the system you're in at the moment? Is it parked? You can do all sorts of stuff with this that we just could not do before. And we have added tons and tons of auto conditions with this ability. And we can just, like I said, do all sorts of stuff we couldn't do before. I think we actually have a wiki page with all of them on it. If you go to the wiki, I think there's a page on player conditions if we want to pull it up. And you can just scroll through all the stuff we have. We actually have the version number next to every single condition and when it was added. I think it's further down, player conditions, not the player's manual. right there above compiling or modifying. Mm-hmm. We describe how conditions work. But see that scroll bar? This is a longer page. And further down, it's a bunch of conditions with what they do, when they're usable, and then what version they were added in. And you can see, I think there's a bunch that come in a single version because that's when we actually got that capability. And then just every version after that, there's another whole set that we shove in because people are like, oh, I want to do this. I want to compare that. And it's just really expanded our capabilities in terms of what we can do with missions.
Mm-hmm. All right. So same question for Sean. On the art side, what has changed in the last, it's been over 2 years actually since we last talked to you guys. So Sean, what is new in the game from your perspective?
So I was saying earlier, there's been a lot of redetailing of outfits and ships. All the sprites for stars got an update as well. Originally, they were more just like a simple gradient with like kind of like flares around it. Now they have more depth to them. Some of them got bigger sizes. Just a lot of ship remodels, especially with like the new factions too. There's also like a ton of new ships, outfits there on that side. With that graphic there, like you can see how in the very old ships were very basic and they looked good. Like for what Michael was trying to go with the game, this kind of retro-y kind of style. But over time, we kind of started adding more detail to the models themselves. And then like
Greeble all the things.
Yeah, Greeble everything. If you want to make sci-fi, just Greeble and yes. Duplication. mostly just reworking old sprites and kind of trying to get everything into a more modernized category. So
Yeah. Has the size of the galaxy in game kind of gotten bigger? Is that continuing to grow as people add more star systems?
So we'll say we do want to have a line eventually to how big we keep expanding the main galaxy, because a lot of what we want to do is for like further galaxies like that. That's very, very down the road for having more than one galaxy. That's very good stuff for plug-in content. But yes, the main galaxy has gotten quite a few more systems to it. It's like the whole right side of the galaxy just got a huge chunk from one of the races. And that's mostly my doing. There's plenty of people who are working on their own factions that want to get them into the game as well. It's ramped up considerably since over the 2 years, and everybody wants to try and grab a slice of the galaxy before it's too late.
Yes.
Well, we want to get onto things like new platforms and some other questions that are sort of backing up here. But first, I have to let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Fastmail. Make email work for you with Fastmail. Customize your workflow with colors, custom swipes, night mode, and more. Fastmail now has quick settings. From the quick settings menu, you can easily choose a new theme, switch between light mode and dark mode, and change your text size without leaving the Fastmail screen you're looking at. Quick settings will also offer options related to the Fastmail screen you're viewing. You can generate a new masked email address, show or hide your reading pane, switch between folders and labels, and more. Choose autosave contacts or choose to show public images of senders from external services like Gravatar. Set default reminders for events, change how invitations are handled, or turn notifications for calendar alerts on and off. Now add or buy a domain through Fastmail, and they will set all the records up for you so it works immediately. Fastmail gives you the ability to send and receive emails from your own domain and manage multiple email addresses in one space, which helps keep you organized and protects your personal data. For over 20 years, Fastmail has been a leader in email privacy. The Fastmail team believes in working for customers as people to be cared for, not products to be exploited. Advertisers are left out, putting you at the center. You pay for free email with your privacy at Fastmail. Your data stays yours with better productivity features for as little as $3 a month. Fastmail has better spam filters and absolutely no ads. And privacy isn't all you get with Fastmail. Superior productivity tools with scheduled send, snooze, folders, labels, search bar, etc. Plus, keep track of all the important details in your life easily with Fastmail's powerful sidebar. Works with password managers like Bitwarden and 1Password to make it easy for you to create unique passwords for every account and safely store them on your device. It is great on desktops and mobile, especially when you download the Fastmail app to get the most out of your email. It's easy to download your old data and import it into your new Fastmail inbox. Fastmail is moving email forward with new internet standards and open source innovations that power many email services other than their own. Don't get left behind by substandard email providers. Reclaim your privacy and boost productivity with Fastmail. Try it now, free for 30 days at fastmail.com/twit. That's fastmail.com/twit. So, Jonathan, you had some platform questions?
Yes. So, Android users, we can now play Endless Sky on Android, can't we? Tell us about that.
Yeah, you can. So, last time we were on, I talked about how somebody had actually created a browser version of the game. I forget the exact link off the top of my head, but I think it was play-endless-sky.com. And you could play the game in your browser. But somebody in the audience actually had a question of, is there a mobile game or a mobile version of the game? And at the time I said no, and we're not planning on making it. Although, since the source is available, it's open source, somebody could actually make a mobile game, mobile version of the game if they wanted. That's actually exactly what happened. So there's this guy called the Weird Nut on GitHub, and he actually made an Android version of the game. It's available on the F-Droid store, and it's tailored to having a mobile interface. So I believe he has, I actually haven't played it myself, but to my understanding, he does tweak the UI to make it actually possible to play on mobile, because if you're playing on a desktop or a laptop, there's a lot of keybinds. Now, not all of them are super necessary, but I believe he's found ways to make most, if not all of them, available to you, even using a mobile interface.
Yeah. So, like, three different directions I want to go with that. First off, we talked with the F-Droid folks just last week on Plus Weekly. That was a lot of fun, so it's neat to see the crossover there. Second, I have spent a little bit of time playing it, and the work to make the game mobile friendly is still ongoing. We'll put it that way. It is a very complicated game to try to do on mobile. I'm curious, though, have you guys thought about trying to pull some of his changes up into the main game? Because, you know, some of his mobile-centric changes could actually be just good UI changes for everybody. Is that something that's being considered?
So we are kind of building a bridge between the main game and his fork a bit more here. So relatively recently, during the last update, I believe, I actually shouted out his game or his fork of the game in our Discord server. I said, hey, I've mentioned the browser before. Well, now we also have a mobile version maintained by this guy. And we also added a link to within our repository, to his repository, when you go to create a new issue. So in GitHub, you're able to have issue templates, but you're also able to say, go to this specific location for these types of issues. And we had at least one or two issues, I believe, that people opened on our repository saying, hey, here's an issue with the mobile version, not even realizing the mobile version wasn't really like official, so to speak. So we made it a bit more official by actually adding a link there that says, hey, if you have an issue with the mobile version, go to this repository, not to us. We probably will look at some of the stuff he has, though, and see, like, hey, maybe we can pull this to the main game. Because I do know he's actually talked to us and said, like, hey, here's some stuff that you could do that could make my life a little easier. So yes, there probably is a bit of a two-way street that we can build there.
So one thing that we want to mention is it's not on the Play Store, is it?
I don't believe so, no, because I think you have to pay to get on the Play Store.
There is.
There might be some licensing issues. I don't know.
You do not have to play it. You do not have to. Google Play, well, there may be a one-time fee. But anyway, there is an Endless Sky on the Google Play Store, and it is not you guys. I want to make sure we make that clear. This is available on F-Droid. I'm sure it's available on GitHub as well. But if you just go to Google Play and search for Endless Sky, you get a totally different game, a platformer that is not what we're talking about.
Yeah, I think we've seen that before when looking up Endless Sky on Google or something and see what comes up.
Right. So we just want to like make sure everybody realizes that. We'll point you at the right place. It's on F-Droid, and let's make sure we get before the end of the show the actual GitHub link to get to the Endless Sky Android. I will get that pulled up. So let's see there. It's on Android. It's in your web browser. Is it on macOS, Linux, and Windows as well?
Yes.
Any challenges with supporting all of those different platforms?
A lot of the challenge of that was worked out by Michael back when we really started the game. We have had some issues that have been macOS specific or Windows specific over the years, mainly around like displaying the window for the game. There's like certain settings that are specific to each OS, but for the most part, we don't really have issues going between the three main operating systems. The one concern that we actually mentioned last time and might still be a thing is that Apple has deprecated support for OpenGL, and OpenGL is actually the graphics library that we use to render the game. So if at any point they completely kill support for it, make it so that you can't even play an OpenGL game, either we have to port the game over to Vulkan, I believe is the Metal, I think it's the Metal renderer is what they use now.
Or on Apple, yeah.
Yeah. So either we need to have a Metal version of a game, or we just need to drop macOS support entirely. I actually did have somebody I believe a viewer of the show messaged me on Discord last time saying, like, hey, I'm sorry to hear that you're going to drop support for Mac OS. I really enjoy the game, but I can't have anything other than a Mac for work reasons. I'm like, well, you can still play the game for now. and luckily, we haven't been completely shut out of the Apple market yet. So that is a concern for the future, most likely.
This is kind of a tangent, but I just cannot imagine Apple actually killing OpenGL on the Mac, because it's such a foot gun for them. I mean, it's going to kill, it'll kill gaming on the Mac. I just can't see it happening, honestly. iOS, is there an iOS version or in the works?
No iOS version. I don't think anyone has anything in the works, so no.
you take the challenges that we just described for running something on macOS and the challenges we described for putting something on the Play Store. You add them together and you multiply them by about 10 to 20. And that is the difficulty of getting something open sourced on iOS. all right. Doc, I think Doc is ready to jump back in. I hope he is. I'm distracted by all the different things.
I have a kind of a mundane question. So I take it this is not your day job. Do you have day jobs that are other than this? And is a good answer, but I'm just wondering what you guys do with the rest of your lives.
So nobody takes any money for this game. That is something to know. So it'd be kind of difficult to make this a day job. MCO does take donations to support a Discord bot that we have for the server hosting. But otherwise, absolutely no money exchanging hands between anyone for this game. So yeah, this is just a hobby project for everyone involved, which at times can make it difficult to actually work with people because, well, people have real lives where they have to do other stuff. And sometimes people are busy for weeks or even months at a time where we just can't contact them. We kind of have to work around that at times. But yeah, I do have a day job. I don't want to say exactly what it is, but it's in the computer science field, I'll say.
And what about you, Sean?
So I'm in a little crossroads right now. I'm trying to prepare to possibly move states or jump places. So I'm in the process of working that out right now, but
so it is a follow-up question. You don't have to answer this either, unless you really need to be in a secret location, which might be kind of cool in a spacey way. Where do you guys live? I mean, approximately, it just can be a time zone, if nothing else, but just curious.
I'm over
in Pennsylvania.
Oh.
Transylvania. I heard Transylvania. Yeah.
He's over in Pennsylvania. I'm in Michigan.
Excellent. So we had you guys on 2 years ago. We're 2 years from now, what are we going to be talking about?
Most likely some organizational / community changes, perhaps. So something I'll note, being an open source, like community-driven game, we say, there's a lot of aspects to the development of the game that aren't strictly like, oh, here's how you know how to code. Here's the language that we work in. Here's our coding style. There's a lot of concern about, well, how long is it taking us to get to pull requests? What type of pull requests are getting in? What specific content is actually being merged? What content is being rejected? Because we do actually reject and close pull requests from time to time. We feel it doesn't fit in the game. And each of these decisions, generally, maybe not generally, but from time to time, you get people who are very passionate about having a feature in the game or passionate about not having something in the game, and it doesn't quite go their way. So we have to figure out how to work with that, really. We haven't done the best of that in the past, I'll say, but we are working on trying to kind of put things more to stone as to what we are expecting of not only the conduct of the contributors to the game, but also the conduct of our developers and our reviewers, and kind of describing to people up front, hey, here's what you should expect from us. Because a lot of it has also been mismatched expectations of who should be doing what. So, for example, the developers, we kind of lead the vision of the game, but some people had a bit more of an idea of developers should just measure community sentiment on what should and should not get merged. And even if they themselves disagree with something, they should still merge it if enough people agree with it. Now, that's not to say that we are complete tyrants and that we only ever emerge when we feel like it. And if you feel like it, well, we don't care. There is a back and forth to it. It is a push and pull, but there is a middle ground to that that we're still kind of trying to find, I would say. And hopefully in 2 years we have that figured out.
I do want to trail off that real quickly. That does come into, here, let me start. Recent times, there's been a lot more creators wanting to work on the game and get their own, like I said, factions in. So in about 2 years, we're hoping to get the main story for like two more chapters of that going on, because we have three different versions of the same campaign planned, and we've only had the one for the longest time. That is kind of a matter of getting more mechanics in the game, coding, and there is a lot of different like branching stories that have been added, and it's turning into a balance of, okay, now we kind of start narrowing the vision back onto the main story and don't split off into 10 different other side ones. So hopefully we'll be doing that more next time.
That's great. We're getting toward the end of the show, and I know Jonathan has a question queued up. And we'll get to that after I let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Bitwarden, the only open source cross-platform password manager anywhere, anytime. Security Now's Steve Gibson has even switched over. With Bitwarden, all of the data in your vault is end-to-end encrypted, not just your passwords. In the summer 2023 G2 Enterprise Grid Report, they solidified their position as the highest performing password manager for the enterprise, leaving competitors in the dust. Bitwarden protects your data and privacy by adding strong, randomly generated passwords for each account. Go further with a username generator. Create unique usernames for each account or use any of the 5 integrated email alias services. Transparently view all of Bitwarden's code available on GitHub. On top of being public to the world, Bitwarden also has professional third-party audits performed yearly, and the results get published on their website. Bitwarden is open-source security that you can trust. Share private data securely with coworkers, across departments, or the entire company with fully customizable and adaptive plans. Bitwarden's Teams organization option is $3 per month per user, while their enterprise organization plan is just $5 per month per user. Individuals always get Bitwarden's basic free account for unlimited passwords. Upgrade anytime to a premium account for less than $1 a month, or bring the whole family with their family organization plan to give up to 6 users premium features for only $3.33 a month. Bitwarden has launched its new Bitwarden Secrets Manager, which is soon coming out of beta. Secrets Manager keeps those sensitive developer secrets out of source code and eliminates the risk of public exposition. And right now, our friends at Bitwarden want to hear why you love your password manager. They are offering cash prizes in a short video contest. Visit bitwarden.com/talent to learn how to enter and win. Find examples, rules, and submission instructions. Enter by August 13th, 2023. At Twit, we're fans of password managers. Get started with Bitwarden's free trial of a Teams or enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. That's bitwarden.com/twit.
All right, I'm going to jump back in. I had a very dog chasing a squirrel moment last time I was asking questions, but I am back. And I want to do two things. First off, we talked about the Android version. That is on GitHub at github.com/theweirdnut/endless-mobile. So if F-Droid is not your thing, you can go there and get APKs directly. But I want to ask, you know, we've got all these different platforms we support. What's the framework that makes that possible, and what language is the game written in?
So I already mentioned that the rendering engine we use is OpenGL, but the game is written in C++, basically just using the standard libraries from C++ and any of the code that Michael made. So a vast majority of the code base, at least its foundation, was written by Michael years ago. I could not really answer specifics as to how he got everything working, but I mean, he did. And since then, we've just kind of been building on top of the solid foundation that he's made.
So other than OpenGL, you don't use one of the libraries. There's no WX widgets or any of those other, you know, you're not using Qt or anything like that to be able to go cross-platform.
Nope.
Oh,
that's C++ and OpenGL. We're not using an existing engine or a pre-existing engine. It's just our own engine. So kind of crazy.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. It's spelled the weird nut, remember. That's fun. Do you guys actually play the Android version? Have you checked it out?
I have not. I don't know if Sean is.
Yeah, I haven't either, but I do kind of want to download it soon and just kind of test it out, see how it goes, because I do know it is a bit of a lot to put into a smaller device and try to figure out the UI for that. So
yeah. All right. So I want to ask one more question before I hand it back over to Doc. And I'm not sure that this one fits. Maybe you can dive into the plugins idea. What's the weirdest thing that you've seen somebody do with the game? And so maybe in this context, it's going to be, what's the weirdest plugin that somebody has made that you've seen?
Replacing all of the images of ships with images of anime girls. I also saw one where somebody replaced all the sound effects with like meme sound effects. So you can just do crazy stuff like that.
Sean, any thoughts from you on that?
Nothing. I didn't even know that was a thing. But
I've been about.
I can't think of anything weird. Mm. I can only think of like people are trying to do like total conversions of like Star Wars and whatnot, but not something crazy.
Well, that's kind of crazy in and of itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, anime girls creep into everything, I think. They're just there's a force, there's a sort of center of gravity, force of nature thing that goes on with that. We're really at the end of the show, so a quick one. Is there anything we haven't asked you'd like us to have asked that you want to address before we get off?
I'm pretty happy with what we've covered so far.
Mm-hmm. You guys did a great job. So last question. What are your favorite text editor and scripting language? And so that's for both of you. We always ask this stuff.
Sean can start. I went last time.
Okay. Because I already know what you're going to say. I just use Notepad++. I'm not totally in the vibe of code things. I do use VS Code as well, because one of the other devs wouldn't stop telling me to use that instead of code blocks.
So. Oh, code blocks, yeah.
For myself, also Notepad++, same as last time. Last time I mentioned Lua, it's my favorite scripting language. I said I would try and get a bit more into it. That didn't actually work out. At this point, I would say Python, because I am actually using Python a lot for work now. I actually had to learn it for work. To kind of peer behind the curtain a bit, when I got to the position I'm in now, it was a Java position. I was writing stuff in Java. But the company decided to switch over to Python because a lot of our clients use Python a lot more. And our clients have IT teams that are sometimes able to look at the code and they know Python. So we're doing stuff in Python now. I had to teach myself Python on the job, basically, in a span of like a week or two on my first assignment. And since then, there's some things to it that I feel like are a little weird, because I'm so used to Java and C++ and C#, which is just like a completely separate like section of coding languages. But there's things to it I like. So.
I think Python is slowly eating the world like a Python.
Yep.
First it squeezes the world and then and then ingests it. Just wraps around it and does the thing.
Yes. Hug.
Well, you guys are great. And it's great having you on. We'll have to have you back. You're working on something that actually is going to progress. We know this, and we have a rhythm going now. So yes. two years or less.
Another 2 years will be the 10-year anniversary of the game, so that'll be a pretty good time.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Well, let's mark that down. So if we don't get you sooner, We'll get you for the 10th anniversary of the game. And then you'll have 10,000 people on your Discord.
Probably.
and lots of new art and lots of the rest of it. So, and maybe you'll have me as a user because I promise I'll get to it. So thanks an awful lot for being on, guys. And we'll see you in space.
Thanks for having us.
See ya.
It was fun.
Yeah, it was fun. That was fun, Jonathan.
I've got to say, we didn't get to ask him about this. See, now that we've let him go, of course, all the questions I wanted to ask are coming back to mind. You don't see very many open source games, particularly not open source story driven games. And it's really fascinating to me that Endless Sky had so much success in that kind of niche where there's not a whole lot of other players. So that's really interesting. I also think it's neat just the way that they've sort of through patience and trial and error, they've put their community together and they've worked through problems like sort of the retirement of the original dev. Like that kills a lot of projects. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they just were patient and then went back to him and asked, hey, can we make this happen? Patient went back to him again. Hey, do you think we can make this happen and get things transferred over and got his, they got his account translated into an organization account. I mean, it's just a great success story where you've seen other projects fall by the wayside. So it's cool. I like talking to these guys about stuff like that.
It's always bothered me that gaming has not been that big in the open source world. And it's so much of the gaming world is tied up inside Microsoft and Sony and giant companies like that, where it's all proprietary and closed and, fun and adventurous and the rest of it, but it's sort of like they get a free pass, you know, and for being that way. And it shouldn't be that way. I mean, there should be more involvement. I have the same fear with AI, that AI will sort of get trapped into that same, well, you got to have a giant in order to make it happen. And I'm very encouraged about some of the progress is going on in that respect lately, but it's still there as an issue. So I want to plug next week. We have William Kwok of Apache Sea Tunnel coming up. So that is our next week's show. Any last words before we punch out? Jonathan, you got plug Hackaday or anything else you're working on?
Yeah, so I've got two things that I like to plug. The first is Hackaday.com. You can follow my work there. I have a lot of stuff going on between reviews and how-tos. And then there's the security column that goes live every Friday. Some fun news coming on that one. We've got Zen Bleed, which is yet another speculative execution problem, this time in AMD. We're going to do a deep dive into that this week. And then, of course, there's the Untitled Linux Show over on Club Twit. We go live Saturday afternoons and just cover the ins and outs, the news and the how-tos about Linux, everybody's favorite operating system. And that is exclusive to Club Twit members, which is about the price of a cup of coffee per month. And if you're not on Club Twit and you're listening to this show, you really need to go get on Club Twit. Join us for the Untitled Linux Show. It is a lot of fun.
Thank you. This is a great show. And so again, we got a great show coming up next week on Apache Sea Tunnel, and we will see you then.
Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club Twit. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club Twit Discord, a great clubhouse for Twit listeners. And finally, the Twit Plus feed with shows like Stacy's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit, and thanks for your support.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.